We've been in the SSA business for 30 years now, primarily as our products being applied to this arena. But then about 5 years ago, we stood up a commercial space operations center, or COMSPOC, as a subsidiary of ours, focused on the problem of providing commercial SSA services. This is all commercial sensors, all commercial processing, and focused on delivering high-accuracy, timely solutions to our customers. The classic SSA problem 10 years ago, 5 years ago, was I'll just get TLEs from spacetrack.org or CelesTrack, and we'll use those. Unfortunately, those are no longer sufficient for the problems that people are dealing with now. A classic case in point, as of several days ago, the Russian Luch spacecraft operating in GEO began to relocate again and park next to Intelsat 33. By park next to, I'm talking about within 40 kilometers. And the open source suggests that Luch is nothing more than a signals intelligence bird intercepting the uplinks of the ground terminals to Intelsat 33. This is about the 12th target they've hit in the last 3 years. And so it's great fun watching them move around the geo belt, parking next to everybody. But this is the new reality for space situational awareness. It's not just debris, but it's also, I would say, questionable actors. And keeping tabs on what's going on, as well as working with our commercial customers for things like understanding when they have anomalies, is their spacecraft tumbling, what's the tumble rate, et cetera.
Hello, everyone. I'm Greg Cohen. I'm an associate professor at Western City University in the International Center for Neuromorphic Systems. So I'm a little different from most people here because I'm a mixture of a neuroscientist and an engineer. And the reason I'm here is because I work in a field called neuromorphic engineering, which is a term that not too many people have heard. But essentially, it's biologically inspired systems. So it's almost the opposite of biomedical engineering, where you take technology and put it into biology. We do it the other way around. We look at how biology solves problems and then try to build systems, silicon, mechanical, for example, that take those principles and use them to solve real-world problems. So it turns out about 2 years ago, we were playing with these cameras that are inspired by how the retina works. So the pixels work more like photoreceptors in the eye than a conventional camera. We put them on some telescopes to see what would happen, and it turns out they're fantastic for tasks like SSA. So by changing the entire way you do imaging, so these cameras don't have frames, they don't have exposure times, they don't have saturation effects, they don't have motion blur, you get a stream of continuous information out only when there are changes in the detected by the sensor. So you take one of these cameras and you point at a static scene, you get no data out. Only when something moves do the affected pixels send you information. So it's not quite an image, it's not quite a video, it's something in between. And it turns out that that sort of imaging lets you do all sorts of things you can't do with a normal static camera. You can move the telescope, you can image at low power, at low data rates.
My name's Craig Smith from EOS Space Systems. And just to put it in context, EOS has two major divisions, a remote control weapon station division and a space systems division. Ben is the CEO of the group, and I'm the CEO. I run the space systems group. EOS has been in the satellite tracking and space surveillance business for 35 years since the company was created. And we're best known, I think, for precision laser tracking, accuracy up to a down to a millimetre, ranging accuracy from LEO all the way through to GEO, and increasing powers, everything from low power laser ranging system for terrestrial battlefields all the way up to high-power laser ranging systems. Perhaps less known is that we build some of the most sensitive and most accurate passive sensors for space situational awareness, and we have recently been building our own network. We have a station at Mount Stromlo with a number of telescopes, and in cooperation with a partnership with Lockheed Martin, we have another station built out in Learmonth, and building our own network and acquiring large amounts of space surveillance tracks. So we're now, as Ben mentioned this morning, getting something like 12,000 tracks a week. With all that data coming in, you've got to put it somewhere, so we build our own catalogue, we do our own orbit determination, conjunction analysis, and with all that data. Would add on all top of that, we have a significant educational group, and we've been developing with our partners in the Space and Environment Research Centre, we've been developing especially astrodynamics, and we probably now have one of, if not the largest, astrodynamics groups in the country. So really we're just developing systems for space debris, so SSA detection, tracking, characterisation, identification, then effects going beyond.
G'day, Wing Commander Steve Henry, Deputy Director for Surveillance of Space at Air Force Headquarters. In my role, I'm acquiring projects under the Space Awareness Subprogram for Air Force, so that's sensors and mission systems. So we're looking to acquire, as with all defence systems, it has to be 24/7, all weather, day, night, resilient, cyber protected, all that sort of thing. So quite a broad remit, and like I said, we are looking at sensors and mission systems to tie all of that together. SSA underpins all of our missions. We want to know exactly what's going on up there around those critical systems that we rely upon. I'm very lucky in that in this role I get to work with all of our excellent established and emerging industry and academic partners and come to events like this and engage with you all. So thank you.
Good afternoon, folks. My name's James Palmer. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Silentium Defence. We are an Adelaide-based SME that is focused on developing and commercialising passive radar technology for a variety of domains, including land, sea, air and space. I guess we are an example of one of the emerging players in this domain. Our company is just over 2 years old, but we have over four decades of domain expertise in our company through our legacy at DST Group. And it's almost an interesting segue from the previous session because we are effectively one of the representations of a spin-off, as it were, from a publicly funded research agency, being DST Group, but also the work that Alan Duffy mentioned with respect to MWA and looking for space debris was work we did both in collaboration as a member of DST, but now also through Silentium Defence. So we have demonstrated, both through collaboration and through our own data collects and sensors, the ability to do wide field of view surveillance of space using reflected FM radio energy and being able to determine the orbit with sufficient precision to be able to an optical sensor. And so that's why we're looking at the role of passive radar. And I should probably mention, as I said, because we're leveraging FM, we are not radiating, we're not transmitting. True wide field of view, passive sensing, but able to measure range and range rate. So that's where it's a unique positioning in that sense, and that's where we're looking to contribute.
So you can see, ladies and gentlemen, a fantastic panel here, ranging from academia through at SMEs, a very successful Australian Indigenous company, global company, and then the end user. So the takeaway from that is that if there's a question these jokers can't answer, they will make up an incredibly convincing statement that will make you think they know what they're doing. So they've got all the bases covered here. What I'd like to start with, Ken, if we can start with you, a bit of a scene setter. You know, where are we with SSA? And in particular, I've got to say, probably at this conference more than others, space is already contested. There's been, and it has been contested for a while. It's not publicly acknowledged. It hasn't been as much as I've heard it here. Could you talk a little bit about a situation of where are we at? And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that part as well.
Sure. So the threat is fairly well understood. So you can go straight to the Defence White Paper to understand that Defence knows that we are reliant on space. We also know that we are reliant on others to provide us with space situational awareness. We are very, very keen to remedy that for two reasons. The first is because we seek to assure our access to those capabilities that we rely so heavily upon. And the other is to make a meaningful sovereign contribution to the global space situation awareness issue, and eventually down the track, though it's not a defence mission, global space traffic management, because it is an environment that needs to be protected like any other. It's not endless, and it is very, very valuable. We are reliant. I know the boss mentioned it this morning, but I'll chuck it out there again because it's one of our most important pieces of work. We've got an approach to market on Austrade, which is Juliet Delta /Romeo Fox India /9287/1. So if you've got something that you can do with SSA, no matter how big or small or which part of the puzzle, from sensor through to mission system that it can do, please jump on Austrade, have a look, and let us know what's out there. We really are looking to Australian industry to provide us that complete solution.
So what I'd like to do is go from there, and Ben's terrific talk this morning, very, very energetic, very stimulating. He did emphasise that there's different sensors. You know, this is a system. It's not just there's no sense of the silver bullet. So quite apart from the obvious that the ultimate sensing system will be a passive radar combined with a laser system and a neuromorphic camera as the sort of gold-plated solution, what are the opportunities? So what are the opportunities in a complete system sense, do you think? So Tom, if we could start with you, and then we'll work our way.
Sure. So as we looked across the spectrum of sensors, you know, when you try to do this commercially, you run into some perhaps some additional challenges. I've looked at probably several hundred sensors over the last several years, and I've never met a sensor I didn't like, but I sure have met some I can't afford. So you have to get a little innovative. Telescopes are a reasonably cheap, flexible solution. So we've deployed a worldwide network of those, including four here in Australia itself, as well as you want other sensor phenomenology. So our telescopes probably aren't as advanced as EOS. We're not looking at during the daytime. So we employ a deep space radar that can range to geo. We have passive RF sensors doing a medium baseline interferometry. And so there's a mix. Every phenomenology brings a little something to the table. Active RF emissions requires a license and has, you know, many challenges. So passive solutions are preferred in that case, but, you know, many objects don't emit. So you do want a nice, you know, the basket of options to choose from.
Greg, what do you see as the span of opportunities from a, you know, fundamental science point of view?
Well, I think, and this goes back to biology to some degree as well, that you really need to pick the sensor for the task you want to do. And the problem is sometimes we don't always know what that task is ahead of time. So, for example, if you look at, from my point of view, the camera I would build to track a satellite would be vastly different to the camera I would use in an autonomous car to navigate while you drive around streets. And that's what you see in biology as well. You know, an eye is roughly the same, it has the same basic task in most of biology. But the eye of an octopus and the eye of a hawk have the same basic components, but they're arranged completely differently for the task they have to do. So when it comes to something like a neuromorphic camera, when you're building this from the silicon from scratch, you have that power to change what the elements are for the task at hand. The problem that we've had in the past is we didn't know what that task was, so we just built generic prototype cameras. And they were not particularly good at anything. And to some degree, conventional cameras are like that. They're really good at taking photos. But often we don't really want an image. We don't want to take a nice photo of the sky in SSA necessarily. We want to find some information out of that. And we often have to do a lot of processing on the data in a conventional image to extract the information that's relevant to us. So for a defined task, you pick the right tool. But when you don't necessarily know what you want to do, or you have to do competing tasks, let's say you want to detect fast-moving objects in the sky, but also characterize them, then you've got to combine sensor technologies. And that's when this idea of sensor fusion comes into play, where you want to say, well, maybe I have one camera that's good at finding fast-moving objects, but that tasks another camera that's good at taking exquisite photographs of that. So I think the idea is to really say, well, you've got to start building in the ways to have these technologies complement one another from the get-go. Because if you proceed too far down in specializing your camera or your technology or your radar, it becomes increasingly harder to build in interoperability with other sensors. So that's something I feel biology does very well. Everything is very well integrated, and we should take the same approach when it comes to sensing in general.
So there'll be a question on notice there about the clarity of the CONOPS and whether the industry and academia think there's a clarity of CONOPS, which will allow us to do some of that high-level architecting. So I'll store that for the moment. Craig, EOS has got experience in multiple sensor types. Where do you think the opportunities are? And we haven't mentioned data processing or the data side.
Yeah. Well, EOS builds lasers and optical sensors, so obviously the solution is lasers and optical sensors. But in reality, all sensors have their role, and they're all complementary. Steve's the military person who will probably elaborate, but you look in the defence side, you're looking for layered defence. As soon as you use one sensor technology, the bad guys will find a way behind it and do something different. So you need layered defence, a variety of systems, complementary, interoperable, I think, is a key component of that, because if they can't talk to each other, they can't talk to your mission system, then they're kind of useless. And that comes back to data standards, the way data is stored, the way we, our understandings of all the other formats and critical components of having a, both for our own capability, a sovereign capability, but also to operate within the allies. And then we move into space traffic management. Again, you've got to be able to understand what people are talking about, because it isn't actually as obvious as you'd think.
I guess, James, you know, there's issues of wide field of view persistence versus, you know, queuing sensors. There's probability detection versus You know, these are all trade-offs between some of the sensors. What's your take on the opportunities in the sense that Ben was talking about, you know, not just a sensor, but the combinations?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I might come at that from a slightly different angle, because to me it is for the purpose of space traffic management, right? And so what I'm understanding, and as I said, I'm relatively new to the SSA community, but the things that I'm hearing is one of the big challenges actually around custody. And so the ability to have really great coverage across the entire globe, and persistently, so that you're looking at everything all the time, so that you're not, you don't have these really significant periods of no information where the uncertainty on where it is sort of grows, that is part of the problem, right? But, and, you know, obviously geographic diversity is a key component to that, but we can't, you know, it's not cost-effective or pragmatic to put exquisite sensors everywhere on the planet, right? So you need to look at a mixture of exquisite and probably lower fidelity sensors that can fill the gaps and fill in some of that need, right? And so, to me, that also is almost a corollary to the Space 2.0 activities that have changed what's happening in orbit, where you're going from, you know, we heard this morning of the transition away from potentially really large geosats down to networks of CubeSats or small sats at a more cost-effective with a bigger refresh rate. To me, it's the same thing, but it's happening with the sensors on the ground to look up. Yeah. And so it's about making sure that you've got really good coverage, and that's not just spatially, but across the sensing phenomenologies, you know, across all the different wavelengths, as it were, to be able to see as much as you can, and using those sensors with the most effect. Yes, you're going to need those really exquisite, fantastic capabilities to get really refined information, but not for every single thing.
Yeah.
So using it most effectively.
Yeah, so you've brought us back to the architecture question again. So Steve, if you could talk to that a little bit. How, this is going to require a very frank and trusted conversation between on ConOps, on vulnerabilities, which is an even more trusted conversation, because you're talking about adversarial intent and what you know about their capabilities. Are we there yet? How far do we have to go, do you think, to actually get that ConOps across in that big picture way?
Oh, we're pretty close.
Okay. No. So there's good news for industry, ladies and gentlemen. We can wrap up the session right now. Job's done.
So we've currently got an SSA study going on, so we've reached out to a private company to help us develop that exact ConOps. So there's really four functions that we need the sensors to do, which is detect, track, identify and characterise. And I think Dr. Green mentioned this morning some of the characterisation aspects that you can do with optical. I know we've got RF sensing experts in the audience, and you can do some characterisation with RF technologies. And all of these will combine in a complementary manner. So in a lot of ways, it's a wicked problem trying to find that correct mix of capability, cost, coverage. And it's really important to remember that, one, we're not in this alone. So we've got the Combined Space Operations Initiative, which works with the US Combined Space Operations Center, and that's got an ongoing series of working groups. So, you know, there are gaps there that we can fill. It's my personal hope that a lot of the sensors that we develop here in Australia, well, they're not going to stay on our continent. These are going to be sensors that are spread around the world with international partners. So, it is a very complex beast, but I think we're starting at the right level.
So the other thing that came up there, actually, James, you mentioned data standards, interoperability. Tom, I might throw to you about that. That's going to be critical. It's all about a partnership, a global partnership. You know, what do you see in terms of data standards or I think, Craig, you mentioned before, we'll go to you next, but yeah, sort of the lack of standards and how that's impacted your business. So, Tom?
Sure. So it's interesting. As a vendor to customers worldwide, we've seen a lot of, I would say, odd data formats, to say the least, including things like your time tag is picoseconds since January 1. Okay. We can do that. So the challenge is when ingesting data, whether it's sensor data or ephemeris data or anything else, the end person or provider of that data generally cannot change their system to accommodate you. So you may have the most lovely international standard data format ever, but that system was built 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and their data format is fixed and locked down, and it's not going to change. So you have to have some sort of built-in flexibility via plug-in points or some other mechanism in your architecture to adjust to the data provider. But, of course, the products that you put out should ideally be as compatible as possible. So there are international standards. CCSDS is an international organization that has a lot of standards for the aerospace business. Unfortunately, CCSDS standards are primarily oriented around cooperative passing of data around and not non-cooperative sensor data and things like that. But nonetheless, they have a very good start on the problem. So there is opportunity there. You know, common data formats are very nice. I would caution you that there is no universal format, and I've seen about a dozen tries at this. That does not to dissuade you from continuing to attempt to do that, but I've got about 70 different measurement models, and I've yet to see a data format that accommodates more than about a dozen. So.
Sure. Now, when we talk about SSA, the integration point becomes, you know, the really interesting question.
Have you found they can ingest the things like that you would normally do in a radar track transfer, like covariance matrices?
There needs to be a longer conversation because our covariance matrices look different because of the biostatic geometry. Yep. But yes, I think it's all, you know, it is doable. It is achievable, but it needs to be understood.
Question over there?
Yeah, thanks for the talk so far, guys. Craig, you really inspired me to this question. This is something I've noticed across the SSA industry. No one really has a shared understanding of what it means. So, Steve, you told us what it means to you, but I was wondering, is there any difference of opinion on the panel as to what SSA means exactly?
No, I was right.
Thanks, man.
So the sponsor is right?
He's the customer. They're always right.
That's right.
You can look at our doctrine, US doctrine, ESA's definition. Everybody has a different definition of SSA. And at another conference recently, one of the speakers said, a person who has two watches never knows what time it is, right? We just want the best answer we can get, and you know, we're going to get different qualities and different confidences from different sensors. In many ways, it's up to the mission system that we come up with to accept those. Google doesn't ask you what format you should provide the data in. It just tracks your life and knows exactly what you want, right? So I think there's a little bit of a need to get away from the idea that we need absolutely strict standards where we are getting the same perfect data from everybody, and we start looking at ways to combine different forms of data using really smart algorithms, and we absolutely are going to need artificial intelligence and machine learning to help with this problem. I mentioned the CSPOC earlier. That's a unit of about 200 well-experienced US Air Force personnel who've been doing orbital dynamics their entire lives. We've got an AusSpock of about 12 people who are fairly new to space and learning it. It's never going to be 200 absolute experts. We're going to need systems and machines to help them do that work.
From my point of view, I mean, you guys have been talking about sensors and data formats and stuff. But to me, that's the easy bit. Like, collecting data, that's the easy bit. Radars and telescopes, been doing that for decades, right? What's hard is turning data into information. And I think what Stenery was just talking about then is exactly right. So I was wondering if you guys might be able to comment a bit about that challenge of turning various bits of data into actionable information and what the challenges there might be for a SSA.
Good question, Tom.
Sure. So that's a problem we've run into head on. And we really, many of our customers think they have a sensor problem. They don't have enough sensors. And then our challenge back is, well, certainly more sensors is always better, but what you do with the sensors you have is even more important. And so classically, algorithms like Batchley squares and things like that for orbit determination have been used primarily because classically things didn't maneuver, and astronomers were really good at things that don't maneuver. Unfortunately, in GEO, within a typical year, there are 20,000 maneuvers. And a typical GEO commsat now that is launched maneuvers four times a day with electric thrusters. So there's no such thing as a maneuver-free period. So you have to improve your algorithms as a result, which has forced us to go to an optimal sequential filter. There are probably other solutions as well, because there is no maneuver-free or disturbance-free period anymore. And that then ripples into, do you believe your covariance? Orbit estimation algorithm will produce a covariance. The question is whether you believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And then that covariance rolls into your conjunction analysis, your probability of collision, your sensor calibration. It's an area of significant interest.
So we've got about 3 minutes left. What I'd like to do is change the topic a little bit. You touched before, this is a global issue, and we've got two things here: space situational awareness, very much traditionally a military activity, and sometimes hard enough for militaries themselves to work out how to work together and as a federated, you know, global SPOC, if one ever existed. But then we've got this whole global move to a civilian-led space traffic management. So completely different cultures, completely different levels of trust, and yet we're all seeing potentially everything that's up there, and there's sensitivities around that. So you know, Steve, could you just... I'd like to finish off by... This is a global opportunity for Australia, potentially, to take a lead, but it's a huge cultural shift, I'd have thought. What do you think about that, this move?
So, yeah, I'll quickly switch hats to RAF Liaison Officer for the Australian Space Agency. We've got a bunch of experts on legal and industry and government engagement over there assembled to do exactly that work, to lead Australia for that. And it's one of their priorities is SSA to support exactly things like that. I mean, they understand how important the environment is to protect and... Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know... We've got lots and lots of people here in this room who would like to be using space systems and operating and building space systems, who need certainty that they are operating in a stable, workable and friendly regulatory environment. So there's aspects of it right from licensing and regulation through to on-orbit monitoring through to, you know, safe and effective debris removal and end-of-life disposal. So it's a... Yeah,
this kind of rapid democratisation of space information access.
Oh, extremely, yeah. And how many thousand satellites have been planned for the next sort of 5 years? I think it's on the order of 12 or 18,000.
Tom, do you see a shift between, some years ago you never quite heard the words STM, and now it's shifting towards space traffic management?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, the problem with anybody who has a sensor and you point it up in the sky is you're going to see things. Some of those things are in the public catalogue and some are not. It makes it a bit of an awkward discussion when your other customers say, do you have a catalog and everything? Well, yes or no. And so you have to do that delicate dance, particularly with the government as one of your customers. But we're seeing more and more of that democratization improving. Just recently, as of middle of December, CSPOC started releasing 2-on element sets on what were previously U.S. Department of Defense COMSATs. Those are now in the public catalog, so to speak. So that's a nice step in the right direction, and we can only hope for more of that.
Okay. So I think we've got about 5 minutes. I have another question from the audience here. Yes. Thank you.
So
can you state your name and where you're from as well?
So Eva Cairns. I'm from the ARC Training Centre for CubeSats, UAVs and Applications. But one of my research areas is space weather. And so the question I have for you relates to that. We've heard the word environment a number of times, and we've also talked about motion of objects. Now, those objects change sometimes because humans have commanded them to, but sometimes it's because the environment has changed. Do you regard space weather and the associated effects on the ionosphere and the magnetosphere as being relevant here to us in Australia? I hope the answer is yes.
It's a brilliant point, and I'm sorry for leaving it out. You're absolutely right. Understanding what is causing a change, for attribution purposes and that sort of thing is absolutely important, and being able to either include or exclude space weather as a factor. But space weather affects satellite communications and that sort of thing as well. So absolutely, it's part of our architecture, and I apologise for leaving it out earlier. Good point. Thank you.
Can I comment on that? The atmosphere expands and contracts depending on the space weather, so it affects the drag of the satellites. And changes their orbits constantly. So one of the programs we have a long time has been trying to get better models. I mean, it's actually weather, but we use climatological models to look at the global environment, and they just don't relate. Yes, on the long-term average, it's okay, but what's it going to be like tomorrow? It's weather, and so we actually need to monitor it on a daily basis. And so working on that process of being able to look at the atmosphere and see what the drag is doing on a daily basis, and being able to predict it forward, not just knowing what it was like yesterday.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. For the academics out there, if you can come up with a better atmospheric density model, you would be have a license to print money. My quote is, they all are bad, some are less bad than others. But, a 15% error is something that I'm thrilled with. So space weather is huge, not just from a drag standpoint, but also from an attribution standpoint. So we're seeing more and more situations where there's a single event upset or some other sort of a hardware anomaly. Can you correlate that with the space weather conditions or not? Because that folds into the attribution problem that more and more of the spacecraft operators are having to deal with.
Just following directly on from that, I work at RMIT for the CERC program, actually working on improving the atmosphere models. One of the major challenges in my job is actually just getting satellite data to analyze. How do I go about that? What is the way that I get you guys to hand it over?
That's a fair question.
Okay. So I think one of the earlier panelists said no data is free. But there, I think there are some opportunities because I think, for instance, in the context of the research like that, you don't need timely data. You just need data. So I think there's some opportunities there, and this is something that we've been looking at. Is there a way that we can expose data, say, that's 30 days or older, suitable for, obviously, for research purposes? It doesn't affect me commercially because by the time you process it, it's so overcome by events, it's not relevant. So I think there are some potential partnerships that can be struck there. Classically, a lot of the low altitude data is from the satellite laser ranging community. It's exquisite data, and that'd be my first go to. But usually, those satellites are done for geodesy purposes, and they purposely try not to fly them to the atmosphere.
I'll just reflect on very quickly on two points that the Air Vice Marshal made earlier today. He said two things: ecosystem and sandpit. So if anybody is here looking to collaborate and find a way that universities and industry can get together and do research together on some sort of huge data lake that everybody's contributing to, whether it's sufficiently out of date data that it's but still usable for your purposes. I think that would be an absolute genius idea for Australian industry to be able to work together in some sort of large, diverse data set that was just out there. And, I mean, geoscience have done great work for the public good with their data cubes and that sort of thing. So it's possible, it's doable. We just need people doing it.
I'd like you to join with me, please, in thanking our panellists for this afternoon.